It's an overcast day here in California, and the misty weather tends to get me in a philosophical mood. While the subject of anthropology does a good job of focusing on the evidence pertaining to archaeology, the fossil record, and genetics, it fails to acknowledge other aspects of what makes us human, such as what some call spirit or soul, which from my own personal research presents a considerable amount of persuasive empirical evidence. Empirical means verifiable by observation or experience, rather than theory or pure logic. And I've come to understand that there are different layers to our physical bodies, subtler aspects to ourselves, besides bone, flesh, and blood, which could still be considered physical. While modern academia currently lacks effective tools and machines that could potentially detect these subtle energetic bodies, probably because the medical industry is financed and controlled to a large degree by pharmaceutical companies interested in selling pills, ancient schools of thought from around the world not only acknowledge that they exist, but have developed methods of subjectively experiencing these esoteric or dormant aspects of our beingness, even without the use of any drugs. Within yogic philosophy, it is said that our physical bodies are actually made up of several layers. The densest of these is the most obvious, consisting of our bones and our flesh and our blood, all of which are visible, contain mass, and can easily be weighed or measured. This aspect of the physical body is what medical doctors are concerned with and try to treat when you get sick, and what is nourished when we eat food. The next layer is more subtle, and in some circles is known as the vital body, constituted by a bioelectromagnetic life energy, which goes by the name of prana, chi, ki, vril, orgone, or what Master Yoda calls the Force.
Its energy surrounds us and binds us.
While I use the Star Wars reference tongue-in-cheek, I contend that the concept is based on principles grounded in truth rather than fiction. But I'll get back to that a little bit later. First, I'd like to play a short excerpt that elaborates on the different bodies as understood in the Eastern perspective from Indian yogi Sadhguru.
The question is there rebirth? If it's there, what is the basis for one being to go from one birth to another? What is it that carries a person from one to another? Now, if you need to understand this, you must have some understanding of the mechanics of who you are. I'm talking about the mechanics of how a human being is built. See, when you say I'm a human being, the outermost periphery is the physical body. In yoga, we look at everything as body because it is easier for you to understand that way. So we see the body as five dimensions or five sheets. Physical body is known as Annamaya Kosha. Annamaya Kosha means, Anna means the food. This is food body. Next one is called Manomaya Kosha. That means it's the mental body. The third one is called Pranamaya Kosha, which means the energy body. Physical body, mental body, energy body. All these three dimensions are physical. They are physical existence. Physical body is very gross, mental body is subtler, energy body is even subtler, but all these three are physical. It's just like the light bulb is physical, you can see that. The electricity behind also is physical, isn't it? The wire that connects is also physical. The electrons that flow through the wire also are physical existence. So similarly, physical body, mental body, pranic body, all are physical dimensions of life. This physical dimension of life, both in all these three dimensions, carries the imprints of karma. On the body it is imprinted, on the mind it's imprinted, and on the energy it's imprinted. This karmic imprints, or the karmic structure, is what holds it together. Karma is the cement which holds you to the physical body. Karma is the bondage. At the same time, it's only because of karmic stuff you can hold on to the body and be here. This is where spirituality seems to be difficult, because if you try to take it away, it doesn't work. If you try to add, it doesn't work. You need to be just there. If you're just there, it's a moment. Now, the next two dimensions are called Vijnanamaya Kosha and Anandamaya Kosha. Vijnanamaya Kosha is non-physical but related to the physical. It is like a transient state. Anandamaya Kosha is completely non-physical. So, Vijnanamaya Kosha and Anandamaya Kosha means it's the bliss body. There is a bliss body inside which is 100% non-physical. It has no form of its own. Only if the energy body, the mental body and the physical body are in shape, it can hold the bliss body in shape. If these things are taken away, the bliss body will just become a part of the cosmos. So whatever you are referring to as Atman or the soul is a fiction, actually. In the sense, people are describing a certain limitation of the non-physical as a soul. But the body for the soul is still your karma. If the karmic structure is completely dismantled, there is no soul. Everything merges into everything else. What is referred to as Mahasamadhi or Mahaparinirvana is just this, that you slowly understand where the keys are and dismantle the karmic structure so that you become truly no more. When somebody dies, we say, this person is no more. That's not true. That person is no more the way you know them, but they still very much exist. Now, if you dismantle the karmic structure 100%, now you merge with the existence. This is what is referred to as mukti, mahasamadhi. In Hindu tradition, it is referred to as mukti. In yogic tradition, it is referred to as mahasamadhi. In the Buddhist way, it is called as mahaparinirvana. Generally, in English, we are saying liberation. Liberation means becoming free from the very process of life and birth and death. Liberation means becoming free from the basic structures of body and mind. And for all this, the karmic structure is the strings which hold these things together. So when a person dies, obviously the physical body is something that you borrowed from the earth. This body is just earth, isn't it? You understand? This physical body is just a piece of earth which is right now prancing around like this. But you have to pay it back, atom to atom. No interest though. But you have to pay back every atom. You won't be allowed to carry a single atom from this planet. Nobody has managed it. Physical body will fall apart. The mental body and the pranic body, depending upon the strength of your karma, goes on. If the karmic structure is very intense, unfinished, then it has to finish it. If the karma has become weak because it has run its course, then it very easily finds another body. If it has to find another body, the intensity of the structure should come down, it should become passive. If it is very intense, it cannot find. It has to hang. So this is what you are referring to as ghosts. Somebody is dead, his karmic structure is still intense because it's not over. Now he needs much more time to find another body, he still exists. And the more intense his karmic structure is, the more visible he becomes, or more experientially available to people. There are innumerable such beings all around you, if you whether you know it or you don't know it. But most of them you won't feel because their karma is dissipated. They're just waiting for more dissipation before they find another body. But if their karma is very intense, this is why they told you in the tradition, if somebody dies unnaturally, either by accident or suicide or some other way, they will become ghosts. It is not so, everybody becomes. It is just that they are more experienceable. They are more available to your experience because they have more intense karmic structures. So you people may experience them little more than other beings who die of old age. If one completely completes his allotted karma for that life, he will die just like that, without disease, without accident, without any injury. When one dies simply like that, that person may find another body within hours. This is why in this tradition always they said, if one completes his life and dies peacefully, it's the best way to die because he need not hang around. Immediately it goes on. Now when you walk the spiritual path, the ultimate goal for every spiritual seeker is, he wants to break this whole process. Or otherwise, to use an analogy, we can say, what you call as my soul right now is like a bubble. The outer periphery of the bubble is your karmic structure. Inside, there is air. Suppose you blow the bubble, you burst the bubble. Where is the air? Where is your air? There is no such thing as your air. It's become part of everything. So what you call a soul is fictitious because there is no such thing as your soul and my soul and somebody else's soul. Right now, this unboundedness is contained in the limited karmic structure. So it makes you believe as if this is a separate entity. If you take away the keys which hold the karmic structure, then it just collapses. So this afterlife, next birth, don't believe all this nonsense. But right now if you sit here and just close your eyes, you can clearly see more than this body you are, isn't it?
According to various Eastern philosophies, such as Hinduism, consciousness independent of the body exists and is seen as an eternal part of a spiritual realm that returns to the physical realm in a new body. According to various Buddhist scriptures, Gautama Buddha believed in the existence of an afterlife, in another world, and in reincarnation. Quote, since there actually is another world, one who holds the view there is no other world has wrong view. Different traditions within Buddhism have offered various theories on what reincarnates and how reincarnation happens, and some are in contrast to the Hindu version. But the point I'm trying to make is that they all acknowledge that something more than the mere physical material body exists. And some interesting recent research in the West seems to validate this concept as well, while still being alive. Robert Monroe of the Monroe Institute was a radio broadcasting executive who became known for his research into altered consciousness using audio patterns containing binaural beats. These audio techniques were designed to stimulate brain functions, causing the left and right hemispheres to become synchronized, which when combined with instruction, similar to hypnotic suggestion, can lead to out-of-body experiences, a term coined by Mr. Monroe after publishing his 1971 book called Journeys Out of the Body. Since I already covered this in a prior video, I won't repeat myself. However, I'd like to play a brief clip of Robert Monroe being interviewed on a talk show in 1979 where he describes certain phenomena in his own words.
And the author of this book, Journeys Out of the Body. Would you welcome Robert Monroe? What is an out-of-body experience?
Well, an out-of-body experience is a state of being, a state of awareness, a state of action, separate and apart from the physical body. About 25% of the population throughout the world, I guess, has this spontaneously take place that they're aware of at least once in their lifetime.
What happens?
Yeah. What happens? Well, what happens is that you as an individual suddenly find yourself, for one reason or another, apart from your physical body, and yet you can think, you can be, you can act, but your physical body is in some other location. It may be only 2 inches away or 2,000 miles away.
Now, we've heard about people who have supposedly died and then have come back to life. That is also an out-of-body experience?
That is indeed an out-of-body. It's a rather extreme way.
You believe in that, then?
Oh, yes.
So, in other words, if someone's in an awful automobile accident, and the next thing they know, they're kind of floating above it, watching...
That's what we mean by a spontaneous one, as it were. And it is very, very common. And also, a very important thing is that everyone does this. The fact that you do not remember it, it does not... infer that it does not happen. For example, during what we call delta sleep at night, which everyone goes through, is quite probably, according to our researches, the time when everyone goes into this out-of-body state. You don't remember it, but it does take place.
Now, is that like a dream?
No, it's something apart from a dream. It is a... There's no philosophic connotation in our approach to it, but it is somewhat a process of the recharging mechanism that you get during sleep.
When you first had yours, were you frightened?
I was totally frightened. Panic-stricken is a better word for it. And I went through, as a result, all the processes of medical examinations, psychiatric examinations, trying to determine why this was happening.
Robert, describe for us your first body. Can you remember it?
Oh, I can remember.
You still look frightened.
Oh, hang on. Very simple. I had been encountering a phenomenon that was like a vibration in the body, and I had gone to my doctor about it, and he had said, oh, that's just nerves and so on, and I would have to wait till this... faded out, and it's not a physical vibration, incidentally. And one night I was lying in bed waiting for this vibration to cool down or fade away, as it were, so that I could simply roll over and go to sleep, because I didn't feel I should go to sleep or couldn't as a result of this taking place. On that particular night I was waiting, because it was a Friday night and Saturday was going to be a beautiful, bright, cold front day, meaning a good day for gliding. So I was lying in bed thinking what a nice time I was going to have that Saturday, getting into these nice thermal lifts and soaring around. That was with a glider, incidentally. And on that particular time, I was in the process of thinking this way. I suddenly felt something bumping against my shoulder. And I looked, and here was this... what looked to be the floor bumping against my shoulder. And I thought, that's strange. I don't remember going to sleep. And I looked across and I said, there's no rug on the floor. I looked more closely and there was something sticking up out of the floor that shouldn't be there. And trying to perceive what this was, I got a real close look, and it was the chandelier. And in desperation, I realized that I was not bumping against the floor, I was bumping against the ceiling. And I flopped around in the air and looked down. And there below me was the bed, and here was my wife in bed, and here was a man in bed with my wife.
Oh.
And my first response is, well, this is an odd kind of Freudian-type dream. And I thought, well, I better get a good look at this man who was in bed with my wife. And I moved over a little bit closer, and with a great shock, I discovered that the man in bed with my wife was me. And then I went through this great emotional surge that I'm dying, death is here, I don't want to die, let me get back in there. And so I swam down to the body, popped in, and how, I don't know. And then I sat up in bed and looked around. Everything was quiet. My wife was lying there in bed, and I looked up, and there was a chandelier. And needless to say, I did not sleep the rest of that night. The next day, I hurried myself down to my favorite doctor, and he knew I was worried, but he couldn't find anything wrong with me. And that began a search. I fearfully tried to avoid letting this take place again, and as things do happen, it takes place again, and you have to fight the surge of panic about it.
You know, I have gone to sleep many times and not remembered going to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I've had what I guess we know as dreams or even nightmares, and I guess they're probably different. So how do you know it wasn't that or it isn't that when you go in and have an out-of-body?
It took me almost a year of very cautious exploration to determine that it was not a dream.
How do you explore it?
Well, first, you go just a little bit and you look around, then you duck back in. Then you go a little further, as I did in the initial stages.
So in other words, you have complete control of out-of-body?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When you go through this in a careful process, you do, yes.
I would be afraid of getting lost. Now, I know that sounds silly, but what if you went out and went around the block or something, got lost, couldn't get back?
I did that a number of times.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, see, it's not so silly. You could get lost.
Oh, you do. It's amazing. For example, unless you have been in a helicopter, for example, over San Francisco at night, let's say you find yourself, if you're only 100 feet over a whole bunch of rooftops, and try and find yourself and see where you are.
Do you have any questions from the audience about this? Jill.
When did this start? How old were you? I mean, was it like you were a kid?
No, it did not start when I was about 40 years old.
Oh. Really? And is it still happening today? I mean, do you...
Yes, in a different form.
But you control it completely today, is that right?
Oh, you mean, wait, you know when you're going to come out, you say, okay, tonight I'm going to go for around the block? Or...
Yeah, well, I've gotten tired of going around the block.
Can you go far?
Far? The farthest is about, well, I've gone around the world once just for the fun of it.
Yes.
This time space gets very boring after a while.
So you don't only go around the world, but you actually go out of the world.
Yes. How many times can you go from Virginia to San Francisco, which has been one of my common runs, before it gets boring?
You like that, Rob?
No, I just have a lot of friends here.
Do you meet anybody else up there?
Yeah.
Well, yes, we do.
Now, can this help people if they learn this out-of-body experience? Can it help them when they die, or they think they're going to die, or their time's up in this
There's
life?
There's a major discovery that comes with the result of such activity or practice. Without any equivocation, without any going past hope, belief, faith, you know that you do survive death. This changes your overview, your perspective. You have that knowledge, and it's not a religious thing. It's not a philosophical thing. It's a very, very pragmatic thing that you do survive physical death.
And you also, as it says in your book, can take terminal patients and relieve them of their pain by getting them to work out of body.
This is what we do. We let them establish a beachhead where they're going so that they're totally familiar with where they're going, and then their fears evaporate completely, and they make nice, neat plans with some friends of theirs there to have a welcoming party, as it were.
So you're not afraid of dying at all, are you?
Well, yes, I don't particularly want to. I have too much to do here, but I'm not afraid of it. I would think I would get rather irritated that if I had to die now, I'd be irritated.
Is it possible, since you've had these out-of-body experiences, you know how you're going to die? Have you seen yourself die yet?
Yes and no. I should give you one illustration that is important to me. I've passed the 20-year mark in this exploration, and I think that I have done this for two reasons. One, to prove that you can do this and still stay physically alive. And the second is that you can do this and still stay reasonably sane.
In the major Christian denominations, the concept of reincarnation is absent. And this is largely based on the Bible, where it states that Jesus Christ died once forever for the sins of all of humankind. That said, some Christian theologians interpret certain other biblical passages as referring to reincarnation. There's evidence that early Christian scholars, such as Origen, a church father in Alexandria, taught reincarnation in his lifetime, but that when his works were translated into Latin, these references were concealed. Most Islamic schools of thought reject any idea of reincarnation, but the idea is accepted by a few unorthodox Muslim sects, beliefs that are deemed deviant by mainstream Orthodox Shia theology. In Jainism, the reincarnation doctrine, along with its theories of karma, are central to its theological foundations, and Jewish mystical texts, or Kabbalah, especially after medieval times, discuss reincarnation, or a soul cycle, especially in regards to Moses, who is said to reincarnate in every generation. This may not be the case for Orthodox Jews, but I'm talking about the more esoteric branches, or among Hasidic Judaism. Several northern Native American tribes and Inuit traditions speak of reincarnation, with shamans often relaying stories of previous lives, as well as descriptions of between lives time. The doctrines of Sikhism teach that the soul exists, and it passes from one body to another in endless cycles until liberation from the death and rebirth cycle is achieved. In Theosophy, the soul is part of a person which belongs to a formless, non-material, and timeless world, and gathers experience through its effort to express itself in the physical world. Afterwards, there's a withdrawal from the physical plane to successively higher levels of reality in death, experiencing a purification and assimilation of the past life. In Scientology, past lives is a key part of the practices taught, where the human individual is actually an immortal spiritual entity that has fallen into a degraded state as a result of past life experiences, which can be compared to the concept of karma. A sort of spiritual counseling is attempted to free the person of these past life traumas and recover past life memory, leading to a higher state of spiritual awareness.
Why do you think man is here on this planet? What's his purpose? Why is he in a body?
Well, he was put here, and he was supposed to make his own way out of it.
Who put him here?
Well, call it a supreme being or higher forces. And he actually, and I hold this in common with many, many sages, he was put here to work out his own salvation. And we feel in Scientology that we've made a very big stride in that direction.
The concept of nourishing the soul to achieve higher spiritual states of consciousness is a central part of mystery schools and secret societies, which view themselves as custodians of ancient techniques which have been passed down for many millennia. Many of these practices were outlawed, and in some cases punishable by death, and went underground and hidden in symbolism, such as the case with the subject of alchemy, which in actuality was not confined to the transmutation of base metals into gold, but in its esoteric form had to do with the development of spiritual gold, spirit or soul. In the occult or Western esotericism, the approach to spirituality is often divided into what is called the left-hand and right-hand path. The terminology is most often used in terms of ceremonial magic, which in all cases harnesses and utilizes sex energy, or the creative life force, to amplify the will of the practitioner. It is an oversimplification to identify the words black and white with good and evil, even though that is often the context in which they are used. But in my opinion, the differences can be better understood in the different methods used, rather than assigning a good or bad connotation to the actions. So, for example, some of the activities practiced by occultist Aleister Crowley is considered by some to be right-hand path, or black magic. And an example would be his cakes of light, which involves the consumption of various bodily emissions and fluids, as well as indulging in controversial, non-traditional sexual practices. What makes this right hand is not so much of a moral judgment as it pertains to the way in which the act is carried out. Aleister Crowley himself has said, quote, "To practice black magic, you have to violate every principle of science, decency, and intelligence. You must be obsessed with an insane idea of the importance of the petty object of your wretched and selfish desires. I've been accused of being a black magician. No more foolish statement has ever been made about me. I despise the thing to such an extent that I can hardly believe in the existence of people so debased and idiotic as to practice it." While I try to provide this information in an objective manner, as an educational video, and not as an endorsement of Crowley, I will say that I believe that much of his writings has been misunderstood because of its symbolic nature. While I won't be interpreting his work in this video, I will say that part of the more esoteric material he taught had to do with harnessing prana, chi, or life force energy through the stimulation of the prostate gland. It is the taboo way that he went about achieving this that, at least in part, has earned him his negative reputation. In other parts of the world, there are alternative techniques that also stimulate the prostate, which may not be as taboo, but in some cases are also seen as bizarre or even dangerous. In India, yogis, after having mastered the transmutation of energy brought about by semen retention, use breathing techniques where the lower stomach is thrusted in and out in a way that, along with Kegels, which is the flexing of the perineum or pelvic floor muscles, can also stimulate the prostate. The orgasmic energy is then channeled up the spine using mental attention to awaken the chakras or endocrine system. Where the mind goes, the chi flows.
If you activate this dimension of energy, other dimensions of life will open up. One thing is, are you ready for those dimensions? So what is Kundalini? Right now, I am speaking. This is Kundalini. You are alert and listening. If you are alert and listening, that is Kundalini. A flower is blossoming, that is Kundalini. A dog is barking, that is also Kundalini. Or in other words, the fundamental life force in the existence, we call it Kundalini. Now within the system, within the human system, if you look at this as a kind of a life package, it's a piece of life. This piece of life is packed in a certain way with layers of this energy. One dimension of energy comes alive immediately because that is necessary for your survival process. The other dimensions of energy will not come alive unless you do something about it. Unless you're aware of it and activate it in a certain way, they do not come into existence. They remain dormant. The dormant energy is way bigger than the energy that is in use right now. To take care of your survival process, to live a physical life completely, to live a complete physical and intellectual life, you need to activate only about 21 of your chakras. Out of this 114, if about 21 of them are on, you will live a complete life, you will not feel any inadequacy, you will live a complete physical life. There'll be no problem with your life, you will think you're a great success, but you are only 21, that is less than 21% out of 114. less than 20%. At less than 20%, you will feel like a complete life without any inadequacies. The remaining percentage of life, what is it about? It is not even needed if your intention is just to live well. If you activate this dimension of energy, other dimensions of life will open up. One thing is, are you ready for those dimensions? The question is not about whether it's good or bad. The question is just about, are you ready for it? Because even if the best things in life come to your life, when you are not ready for it, it will not be a good thing for you. In your experience, it will not be a good thing if something came to you when you're not ready for it, isn't it so? Even if it's the greatest thing, it may be the greatest thing, but it came to you when you are not ready for it, then it is not a good thing, isn't it? So are you ready for it is the first question. If you're ready for it, what can we do for it? What can we do to activate? The various ways of doing this, many, many ways, but the Kundalini Yoga. Are people familiar with Kundalini Yoga, practicing or… okay. Kundalini Yoga, I'm not making a comment about anybody, okay? Kundalini Yoga in its essence is the most dangerous form of yoga. I'm saying dangerous because it's the most potent also. What is most potent is always the most dangerous if improperly handled. There are various kinds of energy in the world right now. Even the electricity is being manufactured in… I mean, produced in so many different ways. One of the ways that we do it is through nuclear reactions, nuclear reactors rather. It is the most efficient way of producing energy that we know right now, but it is also the most dangerous way, isn't it? When things go wrong, they go seriously wrong. When they're going right, it is the easiest and the best way to produce energy on the planet is nuclear energy actually. But when it goes bad, it goes bad really bad, like in ways that you can't fix it. So similarly with Kundalini Yoga, it is the most potent and it is the most dangerous. Without the necessary preparation and guidance, without expert guidance, constant guidance and observation, nobody should ever attempt it. But the problem is, books have been written about it and everybody wants to do the highest yoga. Nobody wants to start with A, everybody wants to start the alphabet with Z. This attitude itself is dangerous. What can be a life-transforming force can become a life-destructive force simply because without the necessary commitment and dedication and focus and understanding, it is being handled. Anyway, about rising the Kundalini, if the Kundalini rises, the dimensions of your life will change so rapidly that you must be willing to make the outside adjustments equally quick. Otherwise, things will fall apart in a big way. In the classical yogic traditions, there is a certain type of yoga we teach for people who live in family situations. There is a certain other type of yoga we teach for ascetics. In Isha, we have both the forms. We have ascetic yoga and we have the general yoga. We will never teach you the ascetic form. That is the most potent way to do it. But it will demand a certain dimension of discipline and focus which your regular lives will not allow. If you do that kind of yoga, it will dismantle your outside life instantly. Now this yoga is not designed to dismantle your life, this yoga is designed to make your life happen better. When life happens better, when things happen better, you make more money, your business is going better, your profession is happening better, you are… generally, unfortunately, your longing to seek the higher becomes slower, yes? So in the real sense, it is not the good way to do it, but it's the only way it works in today's world. and it's only way it works for majority of the people. For a small number of people, we can do it other ways. We can bypass all these things and just do very powerful ways of doing things, but it will dismantle all social structures around them, which is not good for everybody to do. So these are different dimensions. Kundalini yoga, if it has to be practiced, you must be in a certain kind of atmosphere. You cannot live in social situations and do Kundalini yoga. Otherwise, in the name of Kundalini yoga, you're doing something simplistic. Otherwise, Kundalini yoga can transform the way you are within days. Suddenly you find you are a stranger in your own home within 2 days of practice, because it will change everything about you. So can we raise the Kundalini? Yes, we can. One way is to create a conducive atmosphere so that slowly it rises. The other way is to provoke it in such a way that it raises quickly. If it rises quickly, then everything changes dramatically. If it rises slowly over a period of time, changes will happen slowly, you will be capable of handling these changes over a period of time. But if it happens very quick, then you will not be able to handle the changes. Things will look like things are falling apart. So there are different ways of doing this. How many ways? There are too many ways. I will not go into how many ways. There are so many ways of doing it. Essentially, there are 112 ways of doing it. There are 112 ways in which you can take this up. From the base to… oh, for this you have to know the structure, otherwise it'll become very elaborate. Out of this 114 chakras, there are 7 which we recognize as 7 dimensions. Out of this, 6 are within the body, 1 just outside the physical body. So if you employ these 112 methods, you will handle the 6th chakras. The 7th one you cannot handle. There are 112 ways in which you can attain to a chakra which we refer to as Agna. But from Agna to Sahasrara, there is no way. There is no way to do it. You just have to jump into an abyss. If you have to jump into an abyss, you should be insane. Or you should have enormous trust in somebody. Somebody says jump, and you are jumping because you have such a deep trust in somebody that when he says jump, it has to be good for you. You simply jump into a bottomless pit. So the journey from the Mooladhara to Agna, there are 112 ways to get there. But from there to there, there is no way. It is just one jump. That can happen in trust, in devotion, or in madness. Choice is yours.
In a more controversial approach in China, techniques stemming from the Shaolin monks, such as the iron crotch exercises, are also performed to stimulate the prostate, generating qi, without direct internal stimulation. I'd like to repeat that I provide this information as educational only. Do not try this at home. Consult your doctor. This is not medical advice. Everything I discuss falls under the umbrella of anthropology, so please understand the difference. The iron egg technique involves hanging weights to the testicles and swinging it back and forth. This is done over time to gradually increase blood flow, flexibility, and resilience in the area, increasing stimulation. It is claimed that it increases sperm count and testosterone, and while I'm not qualified to speak to those claims, I can say that if performed correctly, under the guidance of a professional, this bizarre technique has been claimed by some to bring about elevated levels of qi. So I repeat, do not try this at home. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, please do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description for those who are interested. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Please hit the like button, subscribe for future updates, And as always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.